Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
This episode of Canada Land is brought to you by Douglas, a mattress that is trusted by more than 200,000 Canadians from coast to coast to coast. It's a great mattress at a very reasonable price point. Comes with a 20-year warranty and a great deal for our listeners. Douglas is giving you a free sleep bundle with each mattress purchase. Get the sheets, pillows, mattress, and pillow protectors free with your Douglas purchase today. Visit douglas.ca/CanadaLand to claim this offer. That is douglas.ca/CanadaLand. This episode of Canada Land is brought to you by the Center for Addiction and Mental Health, CAMH. There is an incredible facility right here in downtown Toronto that is helping on the front lines and is doing incredible innovative research. They are a facility that treats everybody with dignity, and they need your help. May 6th to 12th is Mental Health Week. If this matters to you, help CAMH. There's no better place for your resources. Go to camh.ca/CanadaLand and donate now. Help CAMH treat addiction and build hope. This episode of Canada Land is brought to you by HelloFresh, the meal kit service dedicated to making cooking fun, easy, and convenient. For 50% off of your first box, visit HelloFresh.ca/CanadaLand and enter the promo code CanadaLand when you subscribe. Also, people, this week, The Imposter is back with Season 2. Season 2, Aaliyah learns comedy. She's starting at the bottom. She's taking classes. She is getting up on stage. And she is seeing if she has what it takes. And along the way, she is going to interview comedians and talk about comedy. This is going to be an amazing and funny season of The Imposter. If you are not subscribed to that show, go subscribe to that show. When we talk about stuff that Canada does around the world, I feel like Canadians are always bringing up the stuff we didn't do. We didn't go to Vietnam. We didn't go to Iraq. The stuff that we did do, we followed the U.S. into Korea, into Afghanistan, into the first Gulf War. That stuff doesn't come up quite as much. When the Conservative government struck a massive arms deal to make and sell war machines to Saudi Arabia, a country with one of the worst human rights records in the world, this was sold to the public as a matter of simple realism. Hey, if we didn't sell the House of Saud these LAVs, these machine gun wielding armored killing machines, then hey, somebody else would. It's about jobs, people. And the public seemed okay with it. Later, when Justin Trudeau was campaigning and he was questioned about this arms deal, he brushed the whole thing aside. He said it was just a bunch of Jeeps. And the public seemed okay with that. When his government was caught totally misrepresenting itself, Stéphane Dion, who was the Minister of Foreign Affairs at the time, claiming that it was a done deal, that he had no choice but to rubber stamp this arms deal with Saudi Arabia, when in fact it was later revealed that he actively decided to sign off on a remaining 70% of the transaction, the public seemed okay with it. When it was revealed that the Saudis were using very similar weapons to violently intervene in Yemen's bloody civil war, the Trudeau government said, well, you know, we can't be sure that they're using our weapons to do that, but we'll look into it. And the public seemed okay with it. Well, just this past summer, the videos surfaced. Teradyne Gurkha RPVs, military vehicles, armored weapons, manufactured just a few clicks north of where I sit right now in Newmarket, Ontario, deployed by Saudi Arabia to crush their own citizens. There were casualties, whole neighborhoods leveled with these Canadian-made weapons. That news hit just weeks ago, really, and the public seemed, well, the public didn't even seem to notice. The story reported by Stephen Chase in the Globe and Mail, this expose of his was a late summer headline overshadowed by hurricanes, by North Korea, and by Trump, and by Trump, and by Trump. But what we are doing with Saudi Arabia is quite likely against international law. And reporter Stephen Chase, by the way, Stephen Chase is pretty much the only Canadian reporter who's been covering this stuff. He will join me in a moment to talk about it. Wait for it. This episode of Canada Land is brought to you by Sarah Polkinghome, Devin Wiles, Lee Fay, Damian Dweck, Meredith Lowe, Sandra Hennebaum, Aaron Bradford, and Dana Ashcroft. Dana, why did you decide to be awesome?
Because before Canada Land, I didn't really understand the how, the what, and the why behind Canadian reporting and the media. Now I have a tool that can help me understand that and be more critical of the media in a constructive fashion.
This episode of Canada Land is brought to you by the Center for Addiction and Mental Health, CAMH. We got a tour of their facilities in their downtown Toronto campus, and I was blown away by the heroic work that these people are doing. They are saving lives every day. I know people whose lives were saved, and they just really care about the dignity of the people who turn to them for help. Look, we talk a lot about these issues on Canada Land. We talk about the crisis that is claiming 20 lives every day in Canada to drug overdoses, but we don't give you a lot of options of what you can do about it. CAMH is an option. CAMH desperately needs resources that they directly put into their work, saving lives and turning people's lives around. Listen, May 6th to 12th is Mental Health Week. This is when they need your help the most. Go to camh.ca/CanadaLand to help CAMH treat addiction and build hope. This show is sponsored by BetterHelp, therapy online that has served over 3 million people around the world, and it's available here in Canada. And this time of year, we're all emerging from our winter-like seclusion and, patio season and socializing, and it can be terrifically fun, but it can also create a lot of pressure. And some people get, like, anxiety, social anxiety from being out too much. What did Iggy Pop say about social life? It's torture dressed as fun. It doesn't need to be torture. I think it's just about finding, like, the right balance of how much of other people do you want? I mean, we need each other, but I think that at a certain point, it can become overwhelming. And talking to somebody about yourself, about your social life, about your relationships is a way of gaining insight into what is right for you. It's not selfish to examine that with a professional. And as the largest online therapy provider in the world, BetterHelp can provide access to mental health professionals with a wide variety of expertise in mental health. Listeners of the show get 10% off of their first month at betterhelp.com/CanadaLand. That's better, H-E-L-P, betterhelp.com/CanadaLand. This episode of Canada Land is also brought to you by HelloFresh, the meal kit service that is dedicated to making cooking fun, easy, and convenient. Our listeners are trying this out. Jen tweeted a picture of some chicken yakitori that she made for herself and for her kids. You know, I like HelloFresh because chicken yakitori is not something that I would cook for my family unless somebody sent me the ingredients, perfectly measured out, fresh, locally sourced ingredients, and instructions on how to cook chicken yakitori in 30 minutes or less. I might have made a stir fry. I have some other noodle things that I do. I don't know how to make yakitori, but with HelloFresh, you are always being given exactly what you need to expand your repertoire, to keep cooking fun, to keep it exploratory, but also to cook things that have been tested again and again in HelloFresh's test kitchen. I saw this. They make sure the recipes work and they make sure that the recipes are yummy. So try this out. They send everything to you in a special insulated box for free. The shipping is free, delivered to your doorstep. The cold stuff is cold. The meat is vacuum packed and you're just good to go. You don't have to stress about meal planning. You don't have to go stand in line at the supermarket. You don't have to buy more product than you need. You don't have to cook and then realize that you don't have that one spice that actually makes the recipe work. HelloFresh is so convinced that you're going to like what they do that they're giving you 50% off of your first box. They just want you to try it out. So visit HelloFresh.ca/CanadaLand and use the promo code CanadaLand when you subscribe. This episode is also brought to you by FreshBooks. FreshBooks is the cloud accounting solution. It is like the accounting department for your freelance practice or small business. I speak to freelancers. I still get invoices that are made with Microsoft Word or Excel or other free options out there. And I think that this is coming from people who say, you know what, I'm a freelancer. It's a struggle to be a freelancer. I don't need to spend money on something that I can do a version of for free. I understand that mentality. I used to have that mentality myself, but if you really think about freelancing or running a small business, getting paid is a big part of your job. right? Every job is like three jobs: finding work, doing the work, and then getting paid for the work. So yes, if you just think about it as like, what's the cheapest way to make an invoice? It's something you could do for free. But if you think about it as like, this is the third part, this is like a whole endeavor. You spend so much time every week calling up people who owe you money, trying to figure out a way to not jeopardize the relationship, to have that gentle passive aggressive email reminding somebody that they're late. That is a massive distraction from the parts of your job that you want to be doing, and you don't have to spend so much time doing it, and it doesn't have to be so tortured. FreshBooks is worth it for a lot of reasons, but I think it's worth it for that reason alone. It lets you do about 100 other things. Let's just focus on this one. It gets you paid quicker, so try it out. Go to freshbooks.com/CanadaLand. You can try it out. You don't need a credit card. 30-day free trial. When you do decide to use FreshBooks, use the offer code CanadaLand. Thanks, FreshBooks. So are Canadian weapons being used against civilians in Saudi Arabia?
It seems so. Back in July, we got reports through social media. There was video clips. There was photos showing Canadian-made armored vehicles taking part in an attack in Eastern Province, Saudi Arabia. There was a conflict, an internal conflict between the Saudi government and people, civilians in Eastern Province, in an area that's broadly known as Al-Qatif, more specifically in a region of that area called Awamiya, and even more specifically in a neighborhood called Al-Mazara. And in Al-Mazara, there were fights taking place between the local population and the Saudi government, which was spotted using at least one kind of Canadian-made armored vehicle, tactical vehicles made by Teradyne, which is a company in Newmarket, Ontario, in northern Toronto. And later, there was even some clips showing a vehicle Canadians are more familiar with, the light armored vehicles made by General Dynamics of London, Ontario. So these vehicles were taking place in this conflict, in this assault. There were videos of firefights, attacks, and the Saudis didn't deny it. In fact, they defended it.
What do they say?
We put in questions to the Saudi embassy. We explained what we were talking about. They knew what we were talking about because they asked for the questions. And we said, look, there are Canadian-made vehicles being used. We've got these pictures. We've got these videos. An attack on a conflict with civilians, with the local population. We said, have you checked with the Canadian government about this? And instead of denying it or rejecting things out of hand, they said, well, you know, we're fighting terrorists. And this is no different from when the RCMP took down the shooter on Parliament Hill back in October 2014. So they were very clear that this is this is something they thought was necessary and that they thought was fully defensible. There has been a lot of concerns raised about this conflict, even by the Canadian government, before we reported that there were Canadian-made vehicles seen taking place in this. The Canadian government had actually put out an extraordinary warning to Saudi Arabia, saying we're very concerned about the violence here, and basically warning them to rein it in.
Stephen, I'm confused here because the Canadian government's response, I mean, it's kind of changed since Trudeau won. The first response was, well, you know, they're just Jeeps. And then it was, well, it's a done deal. The Conservatives are the ones who set up this deal. We can't change it. And then you found out, no, that's not true. Actually, Stéphane Dion, he actually had the authority to stop like 70% of the transaction and he didn't use it. And that was not really information that was forthcoming from the government. Then the government, their position was, well, we're concerned, but we see these videos. The old videos showed similar vehicles, I think in Yemen, that were being used in ways that would have been problematic. But they said, we don't know that our weapons are being used against civilians. So until you can show that, we're just concerned and we'll keep selling them this stuff. Now you got videos of Canadian weaponry, Canadian vehicles, armored vehicles being used against Saudi Arabia's own citizens. The Saudis are saying, yeah, and so what? And the Canadian response is, we're very concerned, we're going to look into this?
Yes, the Canadian government initially took a different tack from what maybe might have taken place under former Foreign Affairs Minister Stéphane Dion. Chrystia Freeland said that she was deeply concerned about what she was seeing, and she vowed that she would launch a review, an investigation into what is happening. That was in late July, and, you know, months have elapsed. We have heard nothing since.
What's there to review? If there's videos of this happening and the Saudis say, yeah, we're doing this and we feel justified in doing so, then it feels pretty well established that they're like, I mean, they're killing people. I don't know if the specific, is that where we're at now? Does it have to be the specific Canadian vehicle is killing a specific, I mean, they're being used in these military actions and these videos. I mean, it looks like it's a war zone. It looks like it's from Syria or something. It looks like total devastation. They're doing that with our gear.
Yeah, you raise a really important question, which is, what's the threshold? What's the criteria? The fact is that going back for decades, our export control rules say that the onus is actually on the government to demonstrate that there's no reasonable risk of the weapons we sell countries being used against the local population. So the onus is actually on the government to demonstrate there's no reasonable risk. That criteria really hasn't been acknowledged by the government. For instance, when they justified, they laid out a rationale for the Liberal government approving the shipment of General Dynamics combat vehicles to the Saudis back in 2016. They said, we've seen no evidence that these have been used against civilians. But that's kind of moving away from the rules that have been established for decades under the Canadian government's own arms export rules, where it says the real test is, can the government of Canada demonstrate there's no reasonable risk that these weapons might be used against the local population, not whether or not they found a smoking gun.
Yeah, but you literally found a smoking gun. Like, that's interesting, and I think you can hold the government responsible for ignoring that that was the previous standard and moving it to this new standard of like, well, show me that they're actually doing this. But we're there now, right? Like, you actually, the guns, the smoke is coming out of the guns. It's happened.
Yeah, that's the concern. See, I want to just give you a bit more background about what's been taking place in Eastern Province, in the region known as Almia, in the neighborhood known as Almazara. This area, largely known as Al-Qatif, is where the majority of Shia Muslims live in Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia is mostly Sunni. It's never been counted officially, but there's only about 10 to 15% of the population of the entire country that's Shia Muslim, and they live in Eastern Province, and they are a disenfranchised class. They don't have the same opportunities for advancement. They're basically second-class citizens, and they've been in conflict with the government, particularly since Arab Spring. And so this area, this particular neighborhood of Almazara, the government wanted to destroy it because it was an ancient village with narrow streets where their armored vehicles couldn't get through it. And in fact, armored vehicles are a daily feature of life here, in the sense that they use them as checkpoints for people going into this area. So they want to be able to run these vehicles everywhere through the streets and not have these narrow, winding passageways to block them. So they're getting rid of a neighborhood, and they're just raising it to the ground. The UN human rights monitors have raised concerns about this. And then the conflict sort of erupts in January between people, militant members of the local population who don't like this, and the government, and it really explodes in the summer. So yes, back in 2016, the Globe and Mail showed videos that we obtained from local activists, showing the Saudi Arabian government using combat vehicles against their own population in the very same area, in Almia, in Al-Qatif. And now, in 2017, in July, we have found Canadian armed vehicles being used in these conflicts, in the conflicts which both sides acknowledge have killed people. So yes, we have a situation that the sort of critics of arms exports had warned about for a long time, and yet the government is remarkably, plodding in terms of its response. It's been, as I said, weeks and weeks and weeks, and the government just says we're still looking into it. And I guess the concern that's being raised by human rights groups is, do we have a captive regulator in Ottawa? In the federal government, the very same department that's responsible for promoting trade and economic activity abroad, that's the Department of Global Affairs, within that department is also the regulator that's supposed to regulate arms exports. It's called the Export Control Division. So the very same department that has a mandate to do one thing is also supposed to also, you know, essentially police itself. And the concern is we have a captive regulator in that department. This is what human rights groups are voicing, that perhaps there's something wrong with the regulation.
You're saying that the same department that is responsible for, like, making money with these international deals is also responsible for making sure that we're not providing weapons to nations that would use them to trample human rights.
Yes, broadly speaking, I mean, the Department of Global Affairs has two branches in it. It has foreign affairs and it has international trade, but they all fall under the same umbrella. And yes, their job is to cut economic deals and expand economic activity, but also to police and monitor exports.
Do you think that it's a factor that, I don't know, like I'm trying to find a polite way to say this. You say the story came out in July, it developed throughout August. I know that Chrystia Freeland responded to it. It's not like it didn't get any play. I kind of got the sense that people didn't care, that it was not the story that it might have been, especially since, again, the smoking gun to this story that had been brewing for years that all balanced on whether or not these weapons were being used, Canadian weapons against Saudi civilians. And here's like a video, a series of videos proving that it was. I didn't sense the impact that I thought you might have.
Polls show that Canadians, consistently show that Canadians don't like this. We did a Nanos poll in the weeks that followed, and it showed that two-thirds of Canadians, basically 64%, in light of these revelations, do not want us selling these vehicles. On the other side, there was actually only 14% who wanted them sold, and another dozen-odd percent who actually weren't sure and somewhat supported the sale. But you've got, you know, almost two-thirds of Canadians against it. So there's certainly a public will to stop these. September's a busy month. You've got Parliament returning. You've got a lot of things taking place around the world, especially the United States, that's often dominating the headlines. I don't think the issue's going away. I think that a lot of other things are sort of cramming the agenda right now. And I think it also requires the media to step up and hold the government to account, which is what we do.
Yeah. The problem with polls is that they can only count how people feel about subjects that the poll introduces to the person. They don't really measure what people cared about before the poll, you know, brought it up. The other thing about the polling is that there was polling the first time around before it was as solid a story. The first time around when there was suspicion that these weapons were being used in ways that actually violate, you know, international law and human rights. But when it was just a suspicion, 70 to 80%. Last time we spoke, you told me that 70 to 80% of Canadians polled opposed the deal. Then we find out that our weapons are being used to crush Saudi citizens, and 64, actually less Canadians, 64% say they oppose the deal. I don't know what to make of that.
Well, the first poll was actually, I think, a broad indicator of people, whether people thought we should sacrifice human rights for arms sales. So it was a bit of a broader question. In this case, I would argue that our pollster says consistently in the same area. So I don't think that's the issue. I think one of the problems is it was the Harper government which originally signed and engaged the contract. And so I wouldn't say that the Conservative caucus is pursuing this issue with vigor in the way that they might pursue another issue. Yeah. One of the things I hear when they discuss the issue is, you know, we don't want to be raising questions about a deal that we helped put together.
So you got a lack of question period accountability and the kind of questions that you might see if the roles were reversed, because the Conservatives sort of own this deal in a certain way. And you also mentioned that the press is not holding the government's feet to the fire as they might. Let's talk about that a little bit more. Do you feel like, you know, your work along with Robert Fife and some other colleagues, like, are you kind of alone in pushing this?
I wouldn't say alone. I think that Radio Canada International, RCI, has also been stepped up, and we saw CBC at times engage in the issue. I have to say, and it's not a great excuse, but it has been a rather busy last 2 months between North Korea and hurricanes and so on. And the media in Ottawa is not as strong and robust as it once was. Entire companies have been emptied out here, so you don't have the same number of reporters in Ottawa focusing on the files as you did maybe 10 years ago. So there's a bit thinner ranks in the press gallery, and it's been a busy couple of months. But Radio Canada did step up to the plate, and I thought they did a good job. The question, I guess, now is, where's the government's response? How come it's taking so long? And we're not getting any answers on that.
You bring up Radio Canada. They have been following this. In fact, when I went to actually look for the videos, I couldn't find them. And maybe I missed them somewhere, but I looked pretty thoroughly. I couldn't find them in your reporting, the videos that show the Canadian arms and weapons and vehicles being used. But there were like, I don't know, 6 to 8 videos that Radio Canada posted. Did you guys decide not to run those for some reason?
No, I actually can't explain the web formatting and what happened, but no, there was no decision whatsoever. I think we ran pictures and stills, and I guess it's a matter of a bit more searching required to find them.
I see. your work is interesting to me when you see these videos. How do you confirm their accuracy?
There's two things you have to establish. One is, are these, in fact, the models that were Canadian made? I took the videos, we went to Human Rights Watch. They have an arms expert whose job it is to recognize models, and they confirmed that they were Teradyne vehicles. I also went to a retired Canadian general who asked to remain anonymous because he didn't want to be talking in the file, who also confirmed they were in fact those vehicles. I went to one of Teradyne's competitors and they also confirmed they were those vehicles. And I also went to Project Plowshares, which monitors arms exports, and they had confirmed that those are in fact those vehicles. So we had pretty much confirmed the Teradyne vehicles. They had very distinctive markings, especially around the wheel rims. We knew already that there had been Teradyne armored vehicles sold over the last few years. Most of the coverage, of course, of armored vehicles being sold to Saudi Arabia has been about the General Dynamics light armored vehicles. But Teradyne is another company, and we'd actually documented their trade. So we were fairly familiar with that. And then the question was, were these vehicles, in fact, shot in the locations in which they're allegedly being shot in? And so what I did was I found local activists who went to the same spots and sent me pictures of them. Then we, of course, asked the Saudi embassy, who, of course, didn't deny it at all and, in fact, defended it. So that helped cement things and put things together.
Yeah. Their response, I guess, kind of puts it to rest. If any of this is inaccurate, they have every reason to tell you so.
Yeah.
I think that, to a certain extent, Justin Trudeau took ownership of this issue, and maybe he did so in error when he kind of dismissed this whole thing as, some Jeeps that we sold them. The question can then be put to him when you can show evidence of what these so-called Jeeps are up to. Has that question been put to him, and has his position on it changed? Is he still as dismissive about this issue?
His response is, and they are standing behind the same response that we are investigating, and yesterday or the day before, he claimed that whatever you say about us, we're more concerned about the file than the Conservatives ever were. That was the sort of retort he got off in question period. So that's the latest That's the latest angle of response is we're better than the Tories were on this.
The last time you and I spoke, Stephen, what surprised me most about this is that it feels like this brings up kind of like almost like a classic ethical dilemma, where you do have people saying, come on, grow up, this is the real world. If we didn't sell them these weapons, somebody else did. We can't be held responsible for everything that happens with this, and it creates thousands of jobs. And then, you can imagine there's another side saying, well, actually, that's not true. We have to take some level of responsibility. And that is a debate that I haven't actually heard play out last time we spoke, be it in the media or elsewhere. It didn't feel like we were taking responsibility for what our country was doing and as citizens saying, well, do we want this to happen in our name? Is this the way we should be behaving? Has that changed? Do you feel like that's played out in any way? Like, if it is, it's not in any way that I've sensed.
No, I don't have a sense that debate's played out. I think the Conservatives, when they were in power, were more likely to speak in those sort of real politic terms. The Liberals, I think the Liberals, partly because they have a left flank that is more concerned about this, they don't speak in those kind of terms. They don't try to appeal to some kind of real politic argument that, I think Mr. Dion did a bit at the beginning. He said, everyone sells these things. But the fact is that Canada makes claims about its arms control regime. The claims the Canadian government makes about its arms control regime is that it's among the best in the world. However, you currently have in Sweden a government moving to actually introduce democracy and human rights as criteria for arms sales. So there are certainly far more robust regimes. You have Germany just announcing the other day it's not going to sell arms to Turkey anymore.
Yeah.
So you have very interesting developments in Europe that still need to play out to see how enduring they are. That would suggest that we do not have, we can't sort of claim that mantle as one of the best arms regimes in the world. If the government wants to make that argument, they should perhaps, strip away some of the guidelines and the language, their verbiage that they attach to their descriptions of their arms control regime, and that might make it less of a glaring discrepancy.
I think it's a challenge for the government because it certainly is off-brand. It's off-brand Canada selling arms to Saudi Arabia, and brand Canada has never been more linked with the governing administration than it is right now. You know, if the public's not looking to talk about this, they have every reason to ignore it.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. I think that this is certainly not a conversation they want to start, and they try to wrap up the conversation as quickly as possible. So it doesn't really fit with the sort of, motto Canada's back. It doesn't really fit with the sort of feminist foreign policy that they espouse.
Aside from countries claiming to be the most virtuous and the most progressive on this particular issue of arms sales, apart from an interesting academic philosophical argument about whether a country should be doing this or not, there just is like the rules. Like there's just international law, and there are international agreements that we've signed on to. Is there any ambiguity there? Like what you've reported, that's not kosher, right? Like if that's true, the rules state we can't do this anymore. Is there wiggle room in that?
I'm not a lawyer, and I think that the government has written its legislation and its regulations over the years to give it ample wiggle room. You saw that on display when Daniel Terp, the Montreal professor, took Mr. Dion to court to try to stop the Saudi arms deal. And the response from government lawyers was, we have untrammeled discretion and authority to do whatever we want with arms shipments. In fact, we can even ship arms to a country if we know that there are human rights abuses taking place, provided we think there's other rationale for doing so. The fact is, however, the language of the arms export control regime says a government that has a country that has a poor human rights record, you should not be shipping arms to those countries unless you can demonstrate there's no reasonable risk these would be used against civilians there. And I would argue that what we saw this past summer, and of course in previous iterations using other countries' vehicles, I would argue that in fact that's been violated. That in fact there is now a record of a demonstrable risk that these vehicles might be used against civilians. And I guess the question that human rights advocates are raising is, if there is a demonstrable risk, why is the government doing more research? Why is the government still investigating this? So I guess the question that human rights activists and weapons control advocates are asking is, what more do you need? And the government hasn't responded, and I guess we'll be looking forward to some kind of robust response this fall.
Well, the rules exist, and then they only get used if somebody actually, sues, and Daniel Terp has threatened to do so. The last time he did so, the court ruled that, the court's role is not to pass moral judgment, but just to rule on the legality, and they said that there was no evidence at the time that Canadian military equipment had been used to commit the alleged human rights violations. The evidence has now changed. A similar legal action would very likely have a different outcome, and Terp has threatened to launch one.
Yeah.
What do you think is going to happen there?
He has an appeal underway. I guess the question is whether he adds this to his appeal. I haven't been in touch with him recently, but it was my understanding that they were going to proceed to add this to their appeal. The interesting thing about Daniel Terp's legal challenge of the Canadian government's decision to ship and to sell armored vehicles to Saudi Arabia is it forced the government to make public the memos and the rationales for that sale. There is no way that journalists would have gotten those documents otherwise. So that was a tremendous public service that he accomplished there. And it does make you wonder if, taking the government to court is actually the best way to pry documents out of them, given that the Access to Information system, which is the system that journalists have been trying to use for years, is so broken and shoddy. When a law professor from Montreal can force the government to disclose information and details about its decisions that we could not have obtained any other way.
Stephen, thank you very much for talking with me again.
You're welcome.
That's your Canada Land. You can email me about it. I read everything you send me. I respond when I can. I'm at jesse@canadalandshow.com. We are on Twitter at Canada Land. Liking us on Facebook is a way to get our news in your feed, which is where most people get their news. So like us on Facebook or go to our website, canadalandshow.com, read our stories there. Our crowdfunding site is patreon.com/canadaland. Don't forget to subscribe to The Imposter. It is back for season 2 this week. Our upcoming live show will close the Hot Docs Podcast Festival. It is a conversation on stage between me and Daniel Dale of the Toronto Star, who is reporting Trump like no other. It's going to be a great talk. Google Hot Docs Podcast Festival, Canada Land. Get your tickets now. They are selling very quickly. Syndication of the show to community and campus radio is handled by CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria. Visit them online at cfuv.ca. This show is produced by Kevin Sexton. And if you like what we do, please support us on Patreon.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.